Hi, and welcome back to the Childhood Development Initiative's Restorative Practice podcast, where we talk all things RP. For this second season, we resume visiting communities and organisations to collect stories from practitioners around Ireland. We talk to young people, teachers, lecturers, youth and community workers, and restorative practices trainers to gather their insights on the impact of RP in their life and work. Each episode is focusing either on a place with several voices or on a practitioner. If you are not familiar with restorative practices, the restorative approach, the restorative questions, and the work CDI does, you can listen to the first episode of season one of our podcast series where it is all explained.
Hi, I'm Dorothy Daniou, Restorative Practices Quality Specialist for CDI, and I'm delighted to be back on the road for this second season of Circles of Connection. For this episode, I went back to Limerick to talk with Joe Power, who is the Restorative Practices Development Officer for the area. And we talked about his job, the training he's delivering to teachers and youth workers, and also about restorative parenting and how restorative practice were part of his day-to-day life as a father of three. So hi, Joe. Thank you so much for agreeing to take part in this podcast. Please, could you introduce yourself and tell us more about your role here in Limerick?
Okay, thanks, Dorothy. So my role is RP Development Officer for Limerick as part of the Restorative Practice Project in Limerick. I've been doing it a little over 4 years now. The project started in 2013, and the remit is quite broad, but at the same time quite specific. It's to improve the lives of young people in the city. And what's the best way of doing that is to kind of work with the people who come across the young people. So it's teachers, youth workers, residential childcare workers, and by and large offering them the training and then supporting them and mentoring them. So I suppose one of the downsides is I don't get to do an awful lot of frontline work with young people, but I suppose through the work I do in the project, we get to, I suppose, benefit children through the professionals that we work with. I mean, it is great to do the training. You know, the teachers, I'd say most of the work tends to be with teachers and schools, and invariably they come back the second week with some lovely stories. So I know it's making an impact. And then one of the things that I do that I can offer myself directly is maybe to go into schools and run some circles, because even with the training, teachers might be nervous or apprehensive. So it's one thing that I say that I've offered, people have taken up on it, and it's quite enjoyable then for myself, if you like, to go and run some circles, have some circle time, meet young people, have a bit of fun as well, and hear what they think of it. So that's particularly pleasing.
So you mostly deliver training, and I wonder, what are the knowledge and skills you are training people in?
Okay, so the training, the core concepts of restorative practice would be restorative language, which is also known as nonviolent communication, restorative questions, and there's different variations of the questions, but typically there's six questions. So language, questions, circles, restorative circles would be another core concept then. And then around that then you'd have, tools around fair process, shame is huge, just awareness of shame. And when you're aware, then, you know, you're able to make a better intervention, if you like. I mean, one that comes to mind, and one I often tell in my training, is in my old job in a residential care centre, it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I don't know what had happened, but one of the residents, one of the teenage boys, was getting ready to just kind of head out the door, and this is out in the countryside, so maybe 11 o'clock at night, he was putting on a high-vis jacket, he was packing a bag, he was getting ready to go, and for some reason, the concept of shame popped into my head. And one of the things we do when we're in shame is we withdraw, we run away. And I just used empathy. I mean, Brené Brown says the antidote to shame is empathy. There was no point giving him a road safety lecture or you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. So I just said to him, you know, sometimes when things happen, our instinct is to run away. And that was all I said. And I don't know would he have gone or not, but he chose to stay in that moment. And you know, we went down and had a conversation. But it was just empathy. And I suppose it was seeing the behavior as just a shame-based behavior. I mean, even with my own kids as well, you know, they'll do something and the head will go down. Or they might even get angry. And again, I just look at it as opposed to looking at it as, oh, they're being bold, they're out to get their brother or sister or me. There's an element of shame or embarrassment in this. And it doesn't mean we don't get to kind of a resolution or accountability, but I start with some empathy and understanding. And then, as I say, once you get over that and they realize, yeah, that they're safe, if you like, you know, that they can have a conversation, you know, then we can get to figuring out what has happened. But it's just seeing things differently. And shame is really, really powerful. People are fascinated when we start talking about it in the training. So fair process, shame, relationship window as well. You know, the relationship window, you know, the general ways that we can interact with people. Are we doing things to people or for people or with people? So the relationship window, it's probably easier explained with the addition of visual, you know, something with four quadrants or a window. But at heart, what it is, what it says is that it's better to do things with people than do things to people or for people. And oftentimes in our life, in communities, in schools, the temptation is to do things, a lot of times it's to do things for people, you know. So, you know, look after them, give them whatever they need. You say, literally do things for people. And then a lot of times we get frustrated with that, you know, and we realize that the person isn't growing. And then we get frustrated, something has to change, and then we decide to do things to people, you know, and that's where kind of punitive measures come in. But the relationship window, I say, it's kind of has a balance between that. It's about having high expectations and high support and ultimately doing things with people. So you're holding the expectations, but you're also giving them support at the same time. Probably useful if I give an example of that now, maybe. It's just lately one that comes to mind. I just had a phone call with a principal, and she said at the end, I have to go now and talk to some 6 years. And it was around May time. And I said, oh yeah, what's happening? What's going on? And she said, well, it's getting near the end of the year now. And in the last few years, we've had a number of students kind of, I suppose, maybe leaving their mark on the school, you know, it does happen in schools, you know, getting into some mischief behavior. And she said, look, we have to go to them now and give them the talk. And I just kind of had said, look, are you open to a suggestion? And she said, yeah. So, and I said, look, why not just ask them a couple of questions? First of all, how would they like the finish of their year to be? How would they like to feel finishing up in school? And then ask them what they need to do to make that happen. And what she did actually, she actually asked even better questions. She asked, how do you want your legacy to be? Was the way she asked. So she kind of invited them to think about having high expectations. And then crucially, she asked, you know, well, what can you do and what can we do as teachers to make that happen? And they went into their little mini groups and they came up with various ideas and plans. And then when I met her in August, and I was really curious to know how it had gone. And it was the first thing she said that really, really worked well. You know, so it's an example of working with people. You know, she didn't give them the lecture, I think, that she, by her own admission, she might have given before. She went in there, she held up the expectation. And then they worked on various plans and strategies to make it a reality. So collectively, the teachers, the school gave them support. And she said, yeah, she was really, really pleased with the outcome. So obviously, we it's okay to do things for people as well and for kids. You know, I always make that point, you know, in case, I can't do anything for people. Of course you can. And you know, we do loads of things for our kids and for others. You know, again, my own daughter is 13. Lately, she started secondary school. So she has to get the bus. So she needs to be called, you know, a bit earlier than before. And she wants to be called. And I'm kind of suggesting this idea of an alarm clock and give her the responsibility. And she's kind of pushing back on it. And in my own head, I'm thinking, okay, look, for now, she's first year. She's only just started. The far box is okay. So my wife or I will call her 10 to 7 in the morning. We'll turn on the light, et cetera, et cetera. But in my own head, I'm already thinking, okay, I'm not going to be doing this until she's 20. You know, maybe at the end of the year or next year, we'll get an alarm clock for Christmas. But we will move into the with box. I will, if you like, yeah, place the expectation that she does this herself, but with the support. You know, I'm not going to impose it on her. But we will work from the far box to the with box. Definitely, you probably need to see this in front of you when we're talking about it, but yeah.
So that's a very comprehensive and powerful set of skills. And for having worked with you, I know you're also very interested in other approaches complementary to RP. Could you tell us more about it?
Yeah, the one that comes to mind is the trauma-informed approach. And I guess, you know, some trainers around the world. Some countries are, I think, are a bit further ahead maybe than we are in this country, in that, you know, there is, it's trauma informed restorative practice. And I know it's going to happen here. It will happen. But in my own training, I often will introduce a simple idea, one simple idea around trauma-informed, because I know when people hear that, it's like, oh, it can be a big word. It can be a big thing to take on. But Bruce Perry has developed what's known as a brain model of a brain model. And it's very simple, three R's. It's about regulating, relate, and reason. You know, and I encourage anyone to kind of Google him or listen to a podcast, because he'll explain this better than what I can maybe. But the idea is, you know, we need to be regulated first and foremost. It's like an upside down triangle. If you can picture an upside down triangle, which kind of corresponds with the brain, at the bottom is our brain stem. And the idea that we need to be regulated first and foremost. If we're not, and we know this, I mean, if I'm not calm, if your student's not calm, if a teacher's not calm, no learning, or our parents not calm, no learning or educating can take place. So it's about being regulated. So the second part then is about the relation, relating. So regulate and then relate. And this corresponds to the middle of the brain, the limbic system, if you like. And the idea here is if someone that you don't know tells you something, you're probably not going to pay attention to it or act in it. But if someone you do know, someone you have a good relationship with, a teacher you have a good relationship with, tells you something or does something, you know, you're going to take that on board. So the idea that relationship is crucial, you know. And then the top part is reason. So regulate, relate, reason. And reason is to do with the cortex, or the prefrontal cortex. And I know this kind of sounds maybe a little bit fancy for some people, but it in application, what this means is, again, I always relate it back to my own kids. My youngest son, for example, he's 9. If he is crying, if he's done something, if he's really angry, if he's really upset, I'll just give him a hug. I will offer to give him a hug, no matter what he's done, for about 45 seconds, a minute tops, and guaranteed after that minute, he is regulated or some way more regulated. And then, you know, he's starting to relate to me, and then we can get into the conversation. And even for myself, bring it back to myself, if I'm not regulated, I can't have a conversation. I can't do anything. So I need to take a moment, take a few breaths, and then, if you like, do whatever needs to be done. So I say, so really practical applications, and this upside down triangle, I say, have a look, regulate, reason, and relate. And just that concept alone, added to the restorative practice training, it can make a big difference. I mean, at heart, the questions, you know, are not trauma-informed, because if you're asking someone what happened and they're not regulated, it's just not going to work. So we need people to be regulated, and then, as I say, we can go on with the rest of the restorative practice. So that's a big thing for me.
Thank you. So you mentioned your children a few times, and you write a blog also. We can give the details in the description for this episode, with lots of nuggets of wisdom and glimpses into your own practice and day-to-day life. So could you share with us your parenting RP stories and how RP have changed maybe the father you are?
Yeah, I don't know. Will they thank me in years to come when they read my blogs? But no, I think they're quite nice, I think, ultimately. I'm just trying to think of one of the examples now. Yeah, just one example that comes to mind. It's a couple of years ago now, about 3 years ago, I was driving to Cool Camp, which, for anyone who doesn't know, GAA is a sports activity camp. And I had two boys in the back. Sean was 6 and Michael was 8. And Sean had this new pen, you know, fancy pen, whatever. But Michael had it in his hand. So Sean thought it would be a good idea to grab this pen. And of course, Michael then is crying, daddy, daddy, daddy. And I'm driving probably a million miles away, thinking about whatever. And you know, I realized what had happened. And I said to Sean, look, say sorry. Kind of a typical thing that parents might do. And Sean goes, as only a 6-year-old can, sorry. And Michael, you know, wasn't a bit impressed, as you can imagine, apology not accepted. And then just, I suppose, you know, dawned on me at that time, okay, I'm the restorative practice development officer for Limerick. I teach this stuff. I probably should be doing something along those lines. And I just thought of using the questions. And anyone who doesn't know the questions, the first one is what happened. But I didn't need to ask that, if you like. So I just went on to the second question. Sean, what were you thinking when you took that? And Sean then, I say he's 6 at the time, so he's thinking for a few seconds, and he goes, I don't know. you know, and again, I suppose, you know, in my previous parenting, maybe or other parents might think that's an opportunity to give out, oh, you should have been thinking, you should have been this. But with the restorative questions, then I go on and ask the next question. Well, what are you thinking now? And again, there's a pause from Sean. So, you know, he's thinking, and he goes, could have been worse, you know, which again is a reasonable answer, I suppose. But at the same time, it's another question where, you know, a parent previously, I could have got angry with that. But I just kept going with the questions. So question five is, you know, okay, it could have been worse, but it could have been better as well. What could you have done that would have been better? And again, he's thinking, and he goes, I could have asked for it. Okay, so this is all very quick now, maybe 45 seconds. And Michael's been listening the whole time, and he goes, apology accepted. So it was interesting that, you know, when we asked for the sorry, when I asked him for the sorry, there was no apology accepted. And the second time, even though he hadn't said sorry, Michael, you know, was happy. You know, we were able to get on with our day. I'd say the whole thing was maybe less than a minute. But I did follow up later that night then with Michael, because it was interesting, I said, that aspect where he hadn't said sorry. And I just asked Michael, look, when Sean said sorry, you didn't accept the apology. But when Sean didn't say sorry, then you accepted the apology. And just wondered what that was about. And Michael thought for a few minutes, and he goes, because there was something else. There was other stuff, which for me was a great answer. And when I think about what happened in that intervention, Sean took responsibility. He showed some remorse, and he made a plan. There was some repair as well. So the elements of an apology were in there. As I say, when I was able to think of the questions and use them, Sean did the work, and Michael heard that, and you know, we got on with our day. So it doesn't always happen like that. Sometimes I don't think of it, but you know, increasingly I can and I do, and it just makes those little differences. Yeah, I catch myself quicker. I think, you know, sometimes at the start, and this is one of the reasons you mentioned the blog, you know, I was asking myself, what is restorative and when is it and where is it? And I suppose I was writing a lot of articles to try and tease it out. And it was, you feel like, quite formal. But as I said, now it's much more informal. And as well as that, you know, I realize it doesn't have to be, it's not about perfection either. You know, they can be quick, simple interventions. You know, even as lately as last week, you know, I have three kids, by the way, I have a daughter as well, the eldest. And, you know, there was two separate arguments, if you like, and we were able to resolve the two of them in 10 minutes. And just by using the questions, and they get used to them themselves, you know, they get used to resolving issues quite quickly. Fairness for me as well is huge, you know, fair process about engaging them, explaining what's happening and having an expectation clarity. They're the three E's of fair process. So that's quite conscious at this stage. If there's issues around, you know, typical issues around what are we going to watch on TV? What are we having for dinner? You know, I'd like to think that, you know, I'm quite good at hearing from them all. You know, a parent has to make a decision as well, but they get a say, they have a voice, and, you know, we can usually work around whatever comes up. So it is, yeah, it's funny to think about it now, but in some ways it's second nature at this stage. The thing with me, you know, they always say, oh, daddy asks a lot of questions, which I probably tend to do. And for that reason, you know, I suppose it's hopefully a bit more fair with them. But obviously the world isn't universally fair either. I mean, they are aware of restorative practices. Sometimes I test them on how many questions do they know. So they are, I mean, I do have those conversations with them, and they do have an understanding of it about bringing people together. They're quite smart in that way, if you like. And at the same time, you know, when issues do arise, you know, they just experience me as a father asking them a question, asking them what do you think and what needs to happen next. So, you know, it's not conscious in their mind that at those times. I'd like to think they experience a kind of a natural, normal, calmer. I think that's another thing I'd have to say, you know, I'm much calmer now as a parent. Not that I wasn't, you know, in the past, but definitely a lot calmer now. I have skills. I think that's big for me. I think it gives you skills. You know, in the past, maybe you didn't know what to do. Where do you start? How do you approach this situation? And now, you know, you can stop, think, okay, the questions, you know, and the restorative language as well. I think the non-violent communication is a huge addition as well, you know, for people that have done the training.
Could you tell us more about non-violent communication?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really, really simple. It's even, in some regards, it's more simple than the questions. There are six questions, but there's only four skills in non-violent communication. So Marshall Rosenberg was the guy who came up with this, developed it, and there's four skills, as I say. The first one is to make an observation. So, I mean, this is, you know, sometimes we use labels, we use judgments. You're lazy, you're this, you're always late, you're never on time, you never do what I ask. We use all these judgments. But the first and really powerful skill of nonviolent communication is to make an observation. So again, back to a parenting example, you know, put the dishes away, turn off the TV, whatever it is. And then I'll say something like, you know, I've asked you three times now to turn off the television. I've asked you three times to put away the dishes. And when I make that observation, and it's, you know, it's done in a calm tone, they hear it differently. They, you know, as I say, if anyone who tries to say you never do what I say, you're always making a mess, it generally ends up as in resentment or an argument. But when, more often than not, when I can say something like, I've asked you three times now to put away the homework or the dishes or whatever it is, they experience it different. They hear it. They it's almost like holding a mirror up to them. And it's a really powerful skill. So that's the first one, observation. The next one then is about feelings. You know, so it's about, you know, maybe adding a feeling. Look, it's frustrating when I do this, or it's really pleasing. You know, I think some people think nonviolent communication is all about conflict resolution as well. It's not. I mean, it's about celebrating the positive things in life. So, you know, it's really pleasing that, you know, that you can do that, that you can share this with your sister or brother. So using a feeling word as well. I mean, Adam Voigt says, say what you're going to say, but chuck in a feeling. And it's, you know, it's a really powerful thing as well. So observation, feeling, needs. I think this is a real eye-opener for a lot of people, the idea of needs, that behavior ultimately meets needs. Behavior isn't, they're not out to get you. They're not out to make your life misery. They're not out to whatever it is. You know, children are, all of us, all our behavior is our best attempt at meeting our needs, whatever the situation. And the final one then is to make a request. So even, again, sometimes, you know, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you know, we give out, I suppose it comes across as giving out to people, but we don't make a request. So what is it that you can do or the person can do to actually make our lives better, make everyone's lives better? So adding the request is the final one. So there are the four skills: observation, feelings, needs, and a request at the end. And you don't have to do them all every time, but they're a really, really powerful framework for observing the world, observing people, and making a difference. And for yourself, yeah. I mean, I look, again, when I catch myself, you know, and it's not about being perfect or doing this all the time. It's about kind of catching yourself, if you like, quicker. Marshall Rosenberg says, you know, it's about being progressively less stupid, you know, and we all make mistakes, but I find when I make a mistake, I can catch myself a bit quicker. You know, again, another example with kids, there was one day about a year ago now, and my daughter was walking around the house, and I could see by her, you know, she was quite upset about something, and it was something her two brothers had done. And she was walking around the house and she was looking at them. And of course, they weren't looking at her at all. They were engrossed in their own activity. And eventually I kind of called her over. I could see, you know, there was whatever behavior she was doing was trying to meet a need. I could see she was upset. And I just started to have that a kind of a conversation around that, around what is it, you know, what's happened? They should see this, they should see that, they should see that I'm upset. And I said, well, do you think they can? Does it look like they can? And what can we do about it? So I wasn't using any formal language, if you like, but it was just observing, seeing that she had a need at that stage to communicate to them, but wasn't able to do it. And then I kind of just got in there and just helped her to say what she needed to say. But a powerful way of looking at it, the needs. I think that's probably the best starting point is what if I am feeling, you know, whatever, upset or frustrated, what do I need at that moment? And just even asking that question in my head, you know, well, I need a break. I need a rest. I need to move around. I need to get some food. I need to get whatever it is. When I start asking that question, all of a sudden I start become aware of myself. And then I'm better able to make an intervention with someone else or whatever I need to do. But it is about just asking myself, what am I feeling? What am I needing?
And I was thinking, do you do family circle?
Do you know one thing we do? And again, you know, even the first time I did it, I felt a little bit strange. We did an appreciation circle. And we've done variations of this maybe once a month, there or thereabouts. You know, so we all take turns saying something nice about the person on our left, and it just goes around in a circle. or we might all take turns saying something nice about each other. So the one person, the three kids, so five of us in the family, and we'll, one at a time, there'll be four people will praise or compliment or give an appreciation to one person. It'll go around. And yeah, I mean, surprised. I mean, the kids, the youngest in particular, every so often, if we haven't done it in a while, can we do that thing where we say something nice about each other? And yeah, it's something we don't do enough. We don't give ourselves enough appreciations or gratitude, if you want to call it like that. And it's been a really nice, it's been really nice experiences with that.
Lovely practice. And speaking about affirmation and appreciation, maybe we could close this interview with this. What do you think are your strengths as a restorative practitioner?
Learning from my mistakes, I think. You know, I'll go back to, I mentioned earlier, I think Marshall Rosenberg, he says it's not about perfection, it's about being progressively less stupid. And, you know, I'm okay at this stage. I make a mistake and I used to beat myself up a lot more, but I don't. I look at it, what happens, what needs did I have, what was I trying to do? And I'm kind of forgiving of myself. And at the same time, okay, the next time, because look, all these things happen again and again. So I'd like to think I'm reflective. And that I kind of, yeah, I do a little bit better the next time. I fail better, if you like. That expression, ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better. Yeah, I make better mistakes. I don't make the same mistake twice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our show.